Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Greatly appreciate everybody taking time to join us today for another edition of Midrats. And for those that are with the esteemed cohort that is with us live, I'd like to extend an invitation to you. If you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you will find the chat room, where during the course of the show, if you want to join in with some observations you may have or some questions you would like for us to address to our guest, that's the perfect place to go. My co-host and I will be monitored during the course of the show. We've got Paul and Mr. Cal there, our regulars, are athwart the quarterdeck there, ready to welcome on board. And we always appreciate that interplay during the course of the show. And as always, as we Southerners like to do, I want to give you my altar call. If you got to take off during the course of the show, you want to catch up on what you missed, or if you wanted to catch up on some previous shows that you haven't listened to, if you don't already, go over to iTunes, Spreaker, or any of your aggregators that you do with your podcast, and go ahead and subscribe to the free podcast, and that way Midrats will be there for you when it's convenient for your schedule. So let's go ahead and stroll into today's show. And I'm getting more and more comfortable saying this because, as regulars know, I had a little bit of skin in this game, but as what history will show is a failed effort for almost two decades, we and our friends in the West and other locations, with some of the most advanced military and police forces on the planet, tried to build a security force for the people of Afghanistan. And it started slow, developed great urgency, and we tried to sustain it, and ultimately it didn't quite work out. And at a real critical juncture at the end of the first decade of the conflict, an organization that came in and really tried to do a little bit of catch-up and to set the direction that we felt was the best way for them to go was the NATO training mission in Afghanistan, NMTA. And today we are going to talk about not just that experience towards the end, but we're going to talk about the larger efforts to help the Afghans develop what we thought would have been the best security structure for them. And for our guest for the full hour to discuss this will be Dr. Martin Locano and Dr. C.C. Felker. They used a lot of research, as you would expect from two historians, combined with the fact that both of these individuals have a combined 2 years of experience in Afghanistan. And you'll find linked over at the show announcements to their book that you actually can get free online, thanks to our friends at the U.S. Air Force, No Moment for Victory, the NATO training mission in Afghanistan from 2009 to 2011. We're going to use that as the starting point for our conversation. Martin and CC, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks for having us, Sal.
Thank you.
And again, I appreciate both of you gentlemen taking time today to spend an hour with us to talk about a topic that means a lot to a lot of different people, but both of y'all are historians, and I wanted to start the show because one thing that I found fascinating is professional historians, historian by training, you think like historians, you write like historians, but unlike a lot of things that historians write about, what y'all have invested your time and research in here is something that you're also part of the story. As I mentioned in the intro, you both had 2 years of combined experience, and as we all know from those that try to write on things they have personal experience with, it's kind of a challenge to write about something, be objective about something that you're really involved with. So as a start here, I wonder, and CC, let's go ahead and roll it to you to start off with. Talk for a bit about the role of the historian and some of the challenges or differences you may have experienced in trying to write about something you actually had some skin in the game on?
That's a great question. What we wrote. I mean, No Moment of Victory is, you know, essentially a command history, and everyone, you know, you and Eagle One and everyone out in the Salamander sphere are, you know, they've come across or maybe as the command historian have written unit histories at some point in time, you know, and the difference between what, you know, a mid-grade or junior officer or a historian associate assigned with the Center of Military History who may have an MA in history, you know, the difference between what they do, which is important, don't get me wrong, I'm not diminishing that effort, and what we did was significant. So when you're on the ground with a unit and you are, you know, chronicling what that unit has done essentially with a command, as a command historian, you're basically just writing the narrative. And there's probably not going to be a lot of analytical depth because what you don't have is context because you're out in the field and you don't have sources and you don't have time. And the other thing is events are moving so fast that you're barely keeping up with them. What we brought to this this project was context and analytical depth. And I think that came a lot from both of our training as historians, but also we had access to sources, to the context. I mean, the beauty of the internet age is the sources are out there, as long as you got a good Wi-Fi connection, which we did for most of the time that we were, you know, in Afghanistan. We had access to the context that was important to developing the argument that we were making in the book, which was the command had essentially reached back into the dustbin of history and pulled out the modernization theory from the Cold War 1950s and was applying it to developing the Afghan national security forces. That context was there, and essentially that was it. So it was a command narrative that we were coming up with, but the context was important because it laid the foundation for a more thorough and analytical and critical explanation for what NATO was doing in Afghanistan with NTMA from 2009 to 2011. And I'll turn that over to Martin.
Great. Yeah, CC really nailed a lot of the key points about this. But I think one more thing that both of us had to work very hard to do, not just the contemporary issues of working with people every day, developing tremendous personal respect for people who worked as hard as the folks at NTMA did. But I think the value of our training always comes with the backside. And this, to use my own case as an example of this, is my previous publications, my previous research and work were into the development of the South Vietnamese military during the Vietnam War. And so what I found I needed to do more than anything was to make sure to distance myself from the events that I was involved with, but also to distance myself from my training to make sure that I wasn't creating and kind of reifying patterns into place out of the Vietnam example, which was the one I really knew the best. And I think being there surrounded by people who were such experts at what they did that I had to resist the tendency to kind of fall back on my best and strongest knowledge base. And I had to maintain clear eyes to understand that this was Afghanistan in 2009, 10, 11. This was not Afghanistan in 1989, and it certainly was not Vietnam in the 1960s. Although, as time went by, maintaining critical distance, you still started to see a lot of continuity and a lot of patterns and regrettable similarities in the way the effort was designed and executed.
Well, Sal, you raise another point which I need to address. Is, you know, we were both part of the command, and we were in members of the command. So, you know, that creates a little bit of a tension because here we are, we're trained historians. We were brought there to write the book on NTMA, at least in its first 2 years. But that requires a level of, you know, let's say healthy professional skepticism when you're dealing with sources and with people and with, you know, events and with documents that, you know, don't always or would seem or would lead you to think that, you know, it might undermine the mission, which is nothing, you know, we supported the mission, we were part of the mission, but at the same time we were collecting documents and writing a narrative that questioned, you know, many aspects of the mission. And like I said, at the end product, No Moment of Victory, is a critical analysis of what we were doing there. It doesn't mean that the efforts of NTMA personnel were diminished. On the contrary, I mean, those people, you know, all the Navy IAs, the Army, Marines, airmen, you know, were our NATO allies that were part of this command were absolutely dedicated to the mission. And what was accomplished in those 2 years was extraordinary. I mean, from basically nothing, General Caldwell, who's the commanding officer of NTMA for those 2 years, you know, built an industrial-style recruit, train, supply, and assign process that took the Afghan army and police forces from around, I don't know, 200,000 at the time he took command, and with no real training infrastructure, to 352,000 army and police with training centers located all across the country. I mean, there's a significant level of success in that. You know, the other side, the analytical, the critical side, is how they were doing it and what the shortfalls were, you know, in that mission. And that's what the book addresses.
Yeah, let me start by saying first, I enjoyed reading this book much more than I thought I would. But first thing is, there's a lot of wit in here that you guys, I'm sure, snuck in. Unlike most command histories I've read, there's some pretty sharp observations here, which is good. I mean, that's the way it should be. And but I would have headed this book "Lessons Not Learned," and you're talking about the Vietnamization atmosphere. I mean, as a veteran of that lovely conflict, I think I saw it as clearly, probably you did, Milton. If I'm reading right, I think one of the things that got me was first thing is a Kipling quote came into my head when I started reading this: "A fool lies here who tries to hustle the East." And then another one popped in, which was, "Never try and teach a pig to sing; it won't work, and it only annoys the pig." A lot of this book deals with the fact that there's a great quote here, that we were trying to develop people the way they didn't necessarily wanted to be developed, and maybe not the way they should have been developed. And I think the quote I like is, "To its credit, and unlike its predecessor organizations during the Cold War, NTMA recognized there was not an American inside every Afghan. The problem was the realization did not prevent the command from attempting to jam an American inside an Afghan." So with having said all that, tell me about modernization theory and what problems that caused in trying to move the Afghan situation forward during the 2009-11 period.
Go ahead, Martin. You can start.
Okay. I'll start. Yeah, I'll start. CC will come in. He's probably the better theoretician when it comes to this. Kind of dovetailing on what you said, was this in the same way that we attempted to modernize South Vietnam? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one great example, and this is a parallel, and I know it's not quite identical, but if you look at during Vietnamization, when we handed over a number of F-5 aircraft with cracked transmissions that we second-handed out of Iran to the South Vietnamese, we did a similar thing where we brought in these C-27 Spartans and then discovered that we couldn't find new propellers for these planes anywhere on the world. And, you know, so there's kind of repetition of when you talk about that price level of strategic error and the capability we were trying to deliver. But I think the bigger thing was the assumption that technologically driven warfare built around weapon systems was somehow going to deliver a desirable political or strategic outcome in Afghanistan. And too many people believed that if we just put enough money, if we just put enough machines of the right type in the right places, that somehow magic would be happening in a way that would deliver us what we couldn't do with people on the ground. And the problem, of course, is if we step back and look at what worked for the United States in Afghanistan with the earlier incarnation of the Mujahideen, was clear. We had a light footprint. We spent very effectively. We did not try to hand over major capital systems to the Mujahideen for them to operate. We gave them cheap things that worked very, very well and allowed them to be a very painful thorn in the side of the Afghan forces underneath the Soviet tutelage and the Soviets themselves. So I think that when you look at the fundamental assumptions we had, that carbon copying our methodology and our operational art onto a large number of Afghans was going to get us what we wanted, that was where the real crux of the problem lay. And I think, you know, this is really why we bring in the Cold War. Is this, to me, is one of the principal and most misguided lessons that was brought through from World War II. We won World War II not because we had the most complex weapon systems. We won World War II not because we had the most complex and cutting-edge technological advantage systems. It was the exact opposite. It was that we used what we had, our strength, to produce a large number of simple and sustainable systems. You didn't have to kill a king tiger with a Sherman. You had to kill a king tiger with 10 Shermans. And when you look at what we did, how we designed our force, the operational art that we aligned with technology in World War II, the lesson should have been clear, is that things don't have to be the most complex and the most expensive to be successful. In fact, those countries that tried to have the most complex and the most successful systems were those who were defeated in the war. Instead, we drive through right into the Cold War with the lesson that you have to have the technological edge. And I think that primary assumption drove what we were trying to do to the Afghans. We couldn't mirror what the Taliban did with a fairly simple, light, and sustainable model, which looks an awful lot like what we did for the Mujahideen of the 1980s. We instead decided that we had to turn them into some sort of light version of the 21st century American military, which is both financially and operationally unsustainable for most countries in the world. So for me, those were the things I saw that were the principal lessons. I'm sure CC has some additional examples and gradient that he can put on that.
Yeah, there's three other themes that tie into this. In fact, before I get there, if anybody's interested, the inspiration for our argument was a book written by a UNC Chapel Hill professor by the name of Michael Latham, L-A-T-H-A-M, about 10 years ago it was published. Yeah, May 2000, Modernization as Ideology, American Social Science and Nation Building in the Kennedy Era. I read it while I was in grad school at Duke, just read it and toss it away. And then about 4 months into my time in Afghanistan, as I finally got used to what was going on and had been in enough meetings, it dawned on me that basically what we were seeing here was the 21st century incarnation of modernization theory. But quickly, the three other themes that are important that tie into what Martin was saying was, first was money, and that ties into the technology. You know, we were spending, when I was there in 2011, over $1 billion a month recruiting, training, equipping, paying the Afghan army and police forces. You know, the other narrative is professionalization. It was not only that we thought we could provide the Afghans with the requisite technology to ensure that we could transition them to security leave, but was also this notion that we could develop Afghans soldiers and NCOs and officers into professionals on a Western, through the Western template. You know, something that took us, thousands of years, if you want to go back to antiquity, to understand how, you know, we became the professionals that we are today. We thought we could, you know, create those conditions or accelerate those conditions, and that was an important word that was used in modernization theory in the 1950s. We could accelerate the Afghans to professionalism. The third narrative is culture. And, you know, when I wrote that, put that little phrase in there about, you know, jamming an American inside of an Afghan, it was basically pointing to, you know, this call it a problem, call it a challenge, you know, call it what you want, is this, you know, our inability to recognize that we are of a particular culture, and the people we deal with, whether enemies or, you know, or allies, you know, may be of a different culture, and we need to understand those differences, and that are the people we're trying to help may look at the world differently, much differently than we do. And that is something I think we failed to do in Afghanistan. Maybe it was the imperative of time. You know, I don't know, but I think really what it is, it's in our DNA to look at the world through the lens of Western military professionalism. Apply, you know, Western military means and values and technology, you know, to solve problems, even if it's in a non-Western aspect.
You know, Martin, let me roll this to you, because it's kind of your area especially, because in many regards you're talking about Vietnam, and this is kind of a big pixel issue, but it kept coming to mind listening to you over the last couple minutes. But it's got to be an almost Cassandra-like experience to be a professional historian and to actually live through this. I'm not a historian. I just read a lot. And as my co-host was mentioning, you know, I kept getting flashbacks while reading this book. I highly recommend that people follow the link and read it. If you think it's some academic tome, it's not, especially if you served in Afghanistan. It will make you feel a little bit better that it's not just you that had these thoughts and observations. Circling back to where I was before, but is there a cultural issue that we have in our military where especially when you look at not just Vietnam, but also the history of the Soviets in Afghanistan as well. I mean, we as an officer corps, as a leadership, and I include the Department of State here on the civilian side of the equation, it's not so much that, you know, we failed history. History fails us. You had the micro thing. I happened to be in theater right after 9/11, and I ordered a half dozen copies of the first thing that came to mind was because the people I was working with couldn't find these countries on the map. They didn't know Tajikistan from St. Petersburg, Florida. I ordered Hopkirk's The Great Game and just said, just read this. It's got great maps. But, you know, Martin, when you look at Vietnam, and one of the guys that I served with at HQ ISAF in late 08 and early 09, I jokingly have referred to him on the show before as the U.S. Army's oldest major. Because this guy retired in the 1980s, but he was brought back on active duty because of his civil affairs experience in Vietnam. And I wish I'd written down the comments he said, but I think he may have given us an answer before about why we seem to have intentionally ignored a lot of the hard lessons for Vietnam. Was it, you think, a little bit of optimism, a little bit I'm too busy, or a little bit of I'm smarter than what happened before? You know, what type of stew do you think was there that had us so clearly not take the time to look at those benchmarks? Because we all heard at the beginning, this won't be another Vietnam, dot, dot, dot. Here we are in 2021.
Yeah, I mean, there's a handful of book-length answers for that, but I'm going to do the best I can with it. I mean, I think one of the things that we do have to say, and, you know, my father was a Vietnam-era veteran of the non-DOD variety, My uncle was in Vietnam. I mean, I have a lot of personal ties to it, many of which I wasn't aware of until after I started living over there. And relatives would come out and say, hey, I don't know if you know, but so to some level, Vietnam's a little bit personal with me. But I think if you look at the composition of the Vietnam-era military, and then you look at the composition of the all-volunteer military that we are also familiar with now, there is a genuine qualitative difference there in terms of the knowledge, the educational level, the number of languages you'll find that people speak, the number of relevant academic degrees that, you know, you'll come across an E6 with a master's degree in international relations and not be surprised by it now. And so there are some things that are legitimate differences that should give people of today's military era a certain level of confidence. The question then becomes, how useful is that in terms of trying to connect with and help a Afghan who's at best partially literate, who has lived their entire life in poverty that we cannot imagine? And I think that it's not unreasonable to think that we bring a lot to the table. It's just that we're working in Afghanistan with people who probably didn't literally have a table in their house because they couldn't afford one in many, many cases. And that's not meant to be hyperbole. It's just the cultural gap that was there in Vietnam and is there now in Afghanistan, because I know we're done right now, but you're already hearing percolations of us getting involved with Pakistan, so probably a matter of time. But I would say that as we look at the people we sent to ISAF version 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you go all the way through to the end of Resolute Support, these were people that had reason to be competent. But underneath that, the problem that was in Vietnam on the strategic level is the same problem that was there in all of the efforts, international efforts in Afghanistan, which was, what the hell are we doing here and why? What is our overall aim that we're trying to achieve? And how do we do that not in place of local people, but how do we support local people into having enough initiative of their own and desire of their own to do it? And I think that the answers to that are genuinely going to be problematic on a lot of levels, because one of the things that is a commonality is that for so many people in Vietnam living in the South back in the 60s and 70s and even back into the 50s and a few into the 40s, international partners are a great source of income. You live in a country at that time that is not terribly well off. You live in a country that has suffered all sorts of post-colonial problems, and somebody comes along and gives you a living you never believed you could have to be a soldier. Most people are going to take that, especially when you're talking about, in the case of Vietnam and Afghanistan, these are family-based societies. The fundamental unit of society is the extended family, not the individual. So we kind of created the industry of war, I think, in both cases, and missed that, the signs of that and the understanding of that. I mean, we had bits and pieces in both cases that would tell us there were a number of individuals taking money from both sides, and yet we didn't take those to be significant issues. And now I think as time goes by, we're going to see, as we've seen with more and more declassified Vietnam documents, that for a huge percentage of people, this was not a vocation, this was not a national desire, this was the best job in town. And that's pretty much what I think we have to take away from this and think about.
You know, if I can jump in real quick, Sal, on that. You know, the question that would pop into, I think, anybody's head is, well, how did this happen again? You know, this the whole... You know, why did we basically go through the same experience with the Afghans, you know, trying to Afghanize the war as we did in Vietnam? You know, and it's not that I think it's an important point. It's because whenever I hear the phrase history repeats itself, I kind of cringe because I don't think it does. But what it does do, it just kind of goes underground for a while. You know, it's kind of like a, you know, a mountain stream. You know, it flows, and then in the summertime, it kind of dries up, and maybe it goes underground and then pops up, you know, down the mountain somewhere. And I think that's what history does as well. And at the end of the Vietnam War, basically, we put a lid on that thing, and never again, and modernization theory basically, like I said, it went into the dustbin of history, and for good reason. And we forgot about it. And then in 2009, actually probably before 2009, before we got there, you know, it modernization theory percolated back up out of the ground again, and unbeknownst to the, you know, to the policymakers, civilian and military, you know, at the time, because I don't think they had that context, they looked at Afghanistan and basically came to the same conclusions that Cold War theorists like Walt Rostow and Lucian Pai came to, that we can accelerate these folks to a point where they can sustain themselves and will create a market capitalist representative, you know, government in Afghanistan that's going to create stability in that region for time to come. It just didn't work out that way.
Yeah. And just kind of to add one last point to this, I think the most important thing when we talk about the lessons, one commonality is that the single most unlearned group of people in both of these instances were the political leadership. That in neither case did you ever see the development of a coherent, consistent strategy that might outlive any particular election. And those, to me, were the people who put our military in very, very, very challenging positions and essentially, in the absence of strategy, tried to make the military do everything that the other departments of government weren't equipped to do without a clear strategic aim. And as long as you have no grand strategy and no long-term strategy, which we had in neither case, other than in platitudes and sort of mumblings, the military tries to fill the gap as best as it possibly can. And in both cases, the performance was in many ways good, but without that aim to drive that performance and without that understanding of what that aim should be, you're not going to succeed.
And that's a great point because, yeah, I mean, in Afghanistan, NTMA had a long-term vision. I mean, the idea was that, you know, transition was going to occur at the end of 2014. But that didn't mean that NTMA was going to go away. I mean, General Caldwell, his vision was NTMA, I mean, the combat operations would go away, or the Afghans would take over those, if you know, for what they were. But NTMA would be there for years. And if you looked at out-year budget projections, you know, for 4 or 5 years after transition, NTMA was projecting needing around $6.8 billion a year. So, you know, Caldwell had a long-term vision. The problem is that the leadership at NTMA figured, okay, well, we're going to be able to do our thing. Nobody's going to get in our way. But that's not how it worked. I mean, there were factors outside of the command's control that impeded basically Caldwell's vision, undermined the vision. So it was killing bin Laden. It was, and then, you know, President Obama basically looking at that and saying, okay, maybe we're going to accelerate, you know, the transition, so to speak. It was congressional budget hawks, you know, that were looking more and more carefully at what we were spending in Afghanistan. You know, it was factors outside the command's control that ultimately, you know, undermined, you know, its ability to remain there beyond, you know, what it wanted to. But the bottom line is it was, you know, the failure of modernization, you know, and applying Western technology, techniques, money, and professionalism to the army and police forces of a non-Western culture that undid, you know, our effort in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I think you... You referenced successful cases where the United States, and I use United Nations loosely in this, worked with like the Republic of Korea and some other nations to be successful in a joint effort to in the case of the Koreans, force the North Koreans out of their country. So, if that's an example of a good instance, and Vietnam is probably an example of a bad instance of this, what about places? I mean, I was involved in Kosovo, and I see a lot of the same lessons you learned in Afghanistan. We're obviously not learned from Kosovo. One of the things that really amazed me was that in Korea, we worked closely with our allies, the Koreans and other countries. In Afghanistan, reading your book, we didn't even talk to the Afghans until fairly late in the game. Can you kind of go over that and why that, the effect that had on our relationship with the Afghans? Open question for anybody.
Go ahead, Martin. You start. Oh, absolutely. I like to use small examples, and then we'll kind of back away from that. In Kosovo, you're talking about people who, despite relative poverty compared to European Union and European countries in a whole, well, even regional countries to some extent, talking about that part of Europe, there's a lot of really, really well-educated people that did not find English to be that great of a challenge. Afghanistan, we were trying to engage with people who were illiterate in their own native languages for the most part, with, vast percentages, some said 85-90% at different times of the people we were dealing with were functionally illiterate or worse, generally speaking, completely illiterate in their native language. They couldn't tell the numbers on the bills they were paid in, put it that way. So that's one issue that we have to think about, is the difference in between the people we're engaging. But I think it goes beyond that, in that we did have translators, which that's a whole other kettle of fish, because we essentially employed every medical doctor, attorney, and other classes of incredibly important people who brought capacity to the governance side. They got hired into the military side as translators because the money was so much better. But even with the bridge of translators, how much do we really have in common with people who have suffered as much as people that just came out from under the thumb of the Taliban? And I think that's something we really need to think about at a very, very deep level, not because we're not humane, not because, as you all know as service members, we have some of the best diplomatic presence on earth from our military members. They're generally speaking thoughtful people who engage people really well. But it's who you're engaging with, I think, that is such an issue in Afghanistan. They have to be skeptical of a foreigner. What choice do they have? All they've ever seen is foreigners destroy their country and leave, and then a new set come and destroy their country and leave. And they throw a bunch of money around in the interval. So their broader experience, both kind of as a folklore way from generation to generation, and their practical experience of, Dad hung out with the Soviets and look where that got him. Uncle was with the Mujahideen and look where that got him, because that dried up. They just don't have a lot of good reason, in my view, on the Afghan side to believe the things we're telling them or to want to work closely with us. And then flip the coin there, the KATUSA program you talk about and mentioned with the Republic of Korea forces put mixed units in the field. We occasionally put units under Korean command, including American soldiers, in the field. In combat. We never tried to do anything like that in Afghanistan in any meaningful way. We did it in some small fobs, some small places here and there. But generally speaking, the idea of mixed units, we never considered it. And I think that for all of our skill in the field and for all of our quality of our personnel, I just think that's a bridge too far to ask a lot of very, very well-trained people in the world's finest volunteer military to work with an illiterate guy who may or may not smoke opium, who may or may not have other habits that we find abhorrent. Bachabazi comes up. There's a lot of reasons that on our side we found it difficult to engage, and then those go beyond language. Whereas in Korea, that partnership was right there. Obviously, that relationship remains a very close one. With even a lot of intermarriage between American and Korean people as a result of service experience happening day in and day out. We all know those folks, and that's a very close relationship. And Korea is a a place that in many ways, in the way of value of education and value of patriotism, it looks a whole lot like what we would expect and want to see. Whereas the Afghans, I think at so many levels culturally, they baffled us because their loyalty was not to Hamid Karzai. Their loyalty was not to Kabul. Their loyalty was to their family in a compound in one particular place, and perhaps beyond that, to tribe. And they didn't want to really change a lot of things about Afghanistan, whereas I think we trained our people, whether at Fort Dix or wherever you got them ready, you sent them over there with the idea that we're here to help and change. So, you know, it can't be more simple than this. If your neighbor comes over and tells you he knows what color you need to paint your house, you're not going to react to that well. If he comes over to your house and tells you what you should have for dinner, you're not going to react to that well. And extrapolate that onto the Afghan experience of every generation of Afghan had to contend with international presences that wanted to tell them what they needed to do in their country. And for me, it's no more complicated than that.
Well, let me add on to that. That's a great answer. So, in all transparency, I'm looking at some slides, you know, that I cobbled together from various command presentations when I was there. And this was a Sunday. There was a Sunday afternoons were deep dives for the audience. You know, I think everybody knows what a deep dive is. And this particular slide I kept was being presented by a Navy lieutenant, U.S. Navy lieutenant commander, and he was briefing Afghan National Army core values. So think about that. Just U.S. Navy lieutenant commander briefing on ANA core values, and there's not a single Afghan in the room. There were three pillars to these values: God, country, and duty. And under the God pillar, you know, integrity. We must do what is right morally and legally. Honor. Whatever good deeds the ANA do for the Afghan nation is a big honor. Under country, we are privileged to be in service to the country of Afghanistan. Service. We will serve the needs of the country, the Afghan people, the army. Respect. We will always respect and protect the rights and freedoms of the Afghan people. Duty. We are professional soldiers with the duty to defend and protect territorial integrity and bring security for the Afghan nation. I mean, that was the problem. I mean, we were trying to develop a sense of nation, you know, to people in a country that had no sense of nation, historically had no sense of nation. And, you know, how long could it take to get there? How long did it take Americans, you know, to develop a sense of nation? You know, 1865 or at the end of Reconstruction? I mean, I don't know. But it took us a while, and we're part of the Western, you know, narrative to develop a sense of an American nation. And here we've got a U.S. Navy lieutenant commander that is briefing the three-star on the ANA core values that I think he came up with, and I'm not convinced that there was any Afghan input. And if you look at the slide, you can see it didn't look like the Afghans had much of a say in this.
Yeah, I just was thinking about that. I saw worse, as I'm sure we all did there. And a lot of it came from aspirations and desires and theories. And, you know, kind of like what we're doing right here, and we see now and then after the fall of Kabul in August, you see a lot on the military side of the house that is trying to have a conversation inside of our lifelines, active duty, retired, otherwise. But I saw something that played into what really worries me. And for the listeners, again, I recommend the book. You can't beat the price. But a great value in what CCU and Martin put together is the footnotes and the bibliographies. And early on in the book, there was a phrase that caught my eye because it filled a slot that we've talked about here a few times from Niles Gilman and liberal internationalists. And when I read that, the first thing that popped into mind, and y'all cover this in the review in places, is right after 9/11, we had the Bonn Agreement that had all the bright ideas and all the bright people from D.C. and Brussels and your usual top-tier academic institutions that, you know, fell right afterwards into a lead nation construct where Germany initially raised its hand and said, yeah, we'll build the Afghan police. And when I got there, the Germans had already quit and had thrown the hot potato over to EUPOL, the EU police organization, before eventually it went elsewhere during your tenure. And I'm concerned that the civilian people, and I think, Martin, it may have been you that mentioned the politicians, that our politicians, our State Department, for lack of a better phrase, our thought leaders on the civilian side that are the good idea fairies that develop the higher direction and guidance and commander's intent that come down from the pole mill level, where I've been looking for their introspection on their role in the disconnect, but I have not seen it much. And where you're a little closer to it, are you starting to see amongst that, quote, liberal internationalist group that did, are, and will be in critically important positions that give the direction and guidance and the higher intent that our military then tries to execute? Are they looking at the history and of experience here? If so, what have you heard?
Well, I'll jump in. First of all, I'm kind of cynical about all this. I mean, what have you heard of Afghanistan in the last month? And I haven't heard anything. I mean, Afghanistan is just kind of going sinker. So I think that says a lot. I think, you know, the current administration, and you can go back 20 years of administrations, ISAF commanders, senior four-stars, civilian equivalents that all had a hand in what was going on. I think the one thing they want to do is they want Afghanistan to go away as quickly as humanly possible. Will there be an introspective? Will there be a committee, you know, a blue ribbon committee that actually looks at what happened over the last 20 years? I'm not so sure. Will there be the definitive narrative on Afghanistan, like the Army, to its credit, did on Iraq? But how difficult it was getting that, you know, that work out. I mean, there were many obstacles. You know, many in the Army did not want that book to get out, but it got out. So maybe, you know, maybe the services led by the Army will produce that book on Afghanistan. But there's so many narratives so many stories. I mean, you think of 20 years of IAs, you know, the Navy, Air Force, Army. I'm not just talking about the combat forces, because that's another area, but, you know, everyone carried around a little green notebook, Sal, right? I'm sure you had, you know, dozens of them when you were over there. Everybody was taking notes. And where are they? I don't know where they are.
Yeah.
I mean, there are terabytes of information that are probably sitting in the basement of CENTCOM right now that nobody's ever going to get their hands on, because nobody's going to know where it is. And that's not including all the data that it was erased, you know, and just, it's, like I said, I'm hopeful, but at the same time, I'm cynical that we're ever going to, you know, have a full and clear and critical explanation of what we did over the last 20 years. And I think that's a dangerous thing if we don't have that.
One of the things I
found
interesting.
I couldn't agree more with CC.
Sorry. Go ahead. Sorry, Martin.
My apologies. Just very, very quickly, I think one of the things that's going to be absolutely essential to this is making sure that we hear from a lot of Afghans from a lot of different points of view on the Afghan side, including our enemy. Because that's the only way we've begun to crack and understand Vietnam, is we finally started talking to a bunch of people that fought with us
in Vietnam, Vietnamese veterans who had a lot of things to say that weren't comfortable to hear, but were an important and a legitimate part of this overall mosaic if we're going to have something that will carry over and teach us the lessons we need to learn. We have to listen to things we don't want to hear from the people that we failed. And
yeah,
me
was,
means me too, just to
oh,
be
sorry.
Incredibly
okay.
clear about that.
Yeah, I was looking at the coin issue, and you guys have some pretty good quotes about that the counterinsurgents as a are has change agents, and I thought that was good. And then the I think somewhere you said that American journalist Girardet, anyway, key drawback to this coin is that many foreign military personnel come across as naive with little understanding of the often complex tribal dynamics that exist in Afghanistan. And then you have a section in here about where Karzai was telling the U.S., I don't believe in counterinsurgency. Is this Karzai special thing, or is this an acknowledgement that coin was not working the way that General McChrystal thought it would?
Go ahead, Morton. I think it's a very clear divergence of understanding. And, you know, when you talk about Karzai, the only one he ever seemed to have any respect for and trust was McChrystal. We don't have time to get into the others, and I think it's because McChrystal was the only one that ever really listened to Karzai instead of talked at Karzai or attempted to convince Karzai of things he needed to do. And that's just me speculating. I wasn't there every meeting, every time, every change of command. But of the people that I knew of, everybody said that was Karzai's one point of trust. And I think that McChrystal has had a lot of things to say critical about the coin model. We don't need to talk about who is leading it at any particular time to still have a point. What is the insurgency? When you talk about what really looks to me like a civil war, because you're talking about brother on brother. You're not talking about an uncomfortable movement that Afghans don't like. I mean, I think the majority of Afghans would have been pretty comfortable with a more tolerant Taliban administration. I think the things that bothered most Afghans about the Taliban as being one side in a civil war against essentially us, some southern Pashtuns and the Northern Alliance Tajiks, which is really what you're talking about. You know, you're talking about a war based on tribal and ethnic lines and then many tribes split between the two. If you formulate it in those terms and you think of the problem militarily as being civil war, it's a completely different thing than you think of it as somehow being an insurgency. To me, implies that there is already a functioning legitimate state in place and that there is some sort of rebellion or revolting movement within that is a cancer, a virus. And really what you're talking about is one solidified contending version of being Afghan, which is the Taliban version, which had governed the country and had a certain credibility amongst Afghans in that it was a real thing. And then on the other side, you had the Karzai government that for many Afghans was not a real thing. It was not something they had experienced in their personal lives. It was not something that they had a direct connection to. But for the people of the north of Afghanistan, for many of them, the Karzai government was the real and legitimate version. So you have two competing visions, both of which have legitimacy with a lot of Afghans. And to me, the fundamental idea of insurgency implies that one does not have some kind of legitimacy. And maybe that was one of the things that we never really framed right in our minds, was that by calling it an insurgency, we underestimated the scope, scale, and enduring nature of the problem.
And what was the pace of combat operations in Afghanistan? It wasn't the Afghan army. It was the coalition. I mean, I think that contributed to the problem. I mean, certainly, you know, we were making, how do I phrase this? I mean, you know, we were fighting hard. We were killing bad guys. You know, we were following the coin man and trying to do the right thing. But we were not Afghans doing that fighting. And, you know, when we transitioned over to the Afghan army, three years ago, it was obviously not prepared. you know, to take over, to take the security lead for their country. And that, I think there are a lot of factors that go into that. We don't have time because we're running out of time to look at that. But, you know, we were the face of the Afghan government in the field, not the Afghan army.
You know, CC, I guess one of the things that we do have under our control, because when our nation decides that we need to have our military go someplace like we did in Vietnam, like we did in Afghanistan, and we're going to try to help somebody somewhere build a security structure for themselves, one of the things that we can do is make the decision who's going to do it. And one issue y'all brought up that I think is interesting, and it is something that our decision makers and our leaders do have control over in the future, and that's who we send to train. There is a difference between sending active duty units to train, National Guard units to train, or sending contractors out to train. What did y'all see as the advantages and the disadvantages of those three options that people could use? And you know, if you could give three sentences to the next person that has this job, which one would you have in this area?
Well, I would avoid contractors at all costs. I understand it's the least expensive, and from a vulnerability perspective, you know, the contractors are not U.S. servicemen, but I don't, you know, outside of taking a lot of U.S. money, I would avoid using contractors to do that kind of mission. If we're going to do it, then it needs to be, you know, our men and women in uniform. But they've got to be prepared, Sal, before they're put in that position. I mean, that takes a lot of time and a lot of education and a lot of training. I'm talking and not just language skills, which are paramount. They've got to be able to speak the language, but they've also got to have the time to learn the culture. And once they're in country, they've got to embed with the units that they're training. You know, it can't be we're going to sit on the FOB, and then at 8 o'clock in the morning we're going to hop in the armored vehicle, you know, the armored car, you know, and drive out to the training site. Now you've got to live there. You've got to be there basically 24/7, and that's going to be difficult in another Afghanistan situation where the entire country is a combat zone. But if you want to do it the right way, that's the way it's going to have to be done.
Yeah, completely agree with CC, and I think that we have to institutionalize the idea of the advise and train mission and make it a core part of our military capability and function, because we keep rediscovering it every time we need it after we've abandoned the idea that it's important. You know, the advisor after Vietnam, these are the guys who didn't get promoted, and the advisor in and after Afghanistan, these are the guys and gals that don't get promoted on the same rates
Yep.
as people who do jobs within their AFSC or MOS or RAID or whatever. And until we as a military acknowledge the fact that the magic blossoming of funds and people at the State Department to do these jobs is never going to happen, and we're going to have to do it because we keep getting sent to do it, it has to become something that matters within all of the services in a legitimate way. To advise a senior minister of a foreign government is a challenging and complex job, and we're going to be the ones doing that. So we need to accept that and make it a core part of things. The second thing I'll say is, and then I'll stop, is we need those international partners. And, you know, I don't think that the police skills found even in our Guard and Reserve people are applicable. What we saw was the most applicable skills for helping Afghan police deal with the challenges they have, in my view, was the Italian Carabinieri, because they dealt with organized crime, they dealt with drugs, they dealt with societies that could be very potentially hostile to them, and you could be trying to get information from someone who actually is on the other side. You know, they dealt with this sort of gray area and essentially rampant criminality driven by drugs that was a lot of what with the challenges in southern Afghanistan were. So we've got to have the right partners and allies with us if we're going to take the lead. But I think DOD is the only viable option that we have.
And maybe the, you know, the Army's recently established these security force assistance brigades, and maybe that is the first step. I don't know how the quality of these SFABs are right now, but to me, that's a logical step, you know, in the direction of providing effective security force assistance, but, you know, in a way that we understand the people that we're working with. And that's, you know, if we don't do that, if we don't understand, you know, and adapt, we have to adapt. They don't have to adapt, but we have to adapt to their needs. If we're doing that, then maybe there's some successes in the future.
Well, gentlemen, it is coming close to the end of the show. We're going to go a little bit, but let me mention again, the name of the book is No Moment of Victory, NATO Training Mission in Afghanistan, 2009-2011, from the Air University Press at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama. Thank you very much for coming on the show. I think this discussion, I think Sal said early in a chat to me, was this could be a semester-long discussion. I think this is going to go on a lot longer than that, and I'm glad to see that you've captured this window of time, 2009-2011, in Afghanistan, and there are so many lessons to be learned, so much to be gained from this information. I really appreciate you coming on and joining us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you
so much
for the opportunity to talk about the book.
And really appreciate it. Again, just to reinforce what my co-host said, way too fast of an hour. Can't encourage our guests enough to go ahead and get the book by Dr. C.C. Felker, Dr. Martin Lacano. If you want to help understand how the August of 2021 happened, it's a darn good place to start. And again, great, great footnotes. Gentlemen, thank you very much, and we look forward to having you on again sometimes in the future. You've been great guests.
Great. Thanks, Al.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRat. Until next time, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave this friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go.
Hello! Hello!